Good morning. Are you all set for Monday? Golf clubs polished, tennis rackets strummed in sweet anticipation, the shiny trowel sitting expectantly at the back door, begonia, petunias, pansies, oh. Phase one, here we come. Well, Declan Ronayne of Woodies spoke to Ryan yesterday.
We're not in the DIY and garden business anymore. We're in the mental health business because people want to do stuff just to keep busy, keep their heads together while we all just work together to get through this.
God, that's intriguing that the hardware shops and stores around the country have this absolutely peculiar sort of role in that regard for people to go.
Well, it's interesting when the original closure of the schools came, whether that was on March the 12th, and as a team, we sat together and thought, right, this is really serious. And we said, listen, what's going to happen? And we thought, well, obviously, consumers are going to get nervous. It means they won't spend. It's going to get tough. And we thought, right, we're in for a fairly rocky time. And then a week later, we're saying, how do we get our hands on enough paint? Because paint people just defaulted to interior paint because they thought, right, I need something to do. And actually, I've been looking at that wall for how long now, and I'm going to get something done about it. Mm. And we think we'll probably transition from paint to when we open on Monday, and it will be all about gardening.
Yeah.
So we stocked up really heavily on gardening products. Growers from every corner of Ireland delivering into our stores now, today and tomorrow. And we think people are going to descend on us because they really, really want something to do, to say, look at what I've done or what I've achieved during this really difficult time.
Oh, bring it on. And the numbers, although not perfect, are definitely getting better. Here's Sinead Crowley on Morning Ireland yesterday.
What is the overall trend in terms of the number of new cases, the number of deaths? We saw a further 10 fatalities reported yesterday, and this reproduction rate.
That's right. Thursday is always the day we hear from Professor Philip Nolan, who's involved in modelling, and he gives the reproduction rate of the virus, and that's being described as currently stable. It's between 0.4 and 0.6. And as we heard last week, a 0.5 figure would mean that two people would only pass it to one person and so on. So you can see that it's decreasing. So between 0.4 and 0.6 again this week is seen as very stable. And the other figures that they're looking at are also going down. For example, people in hospital, there was a height at one stage of 865, that yesterday is down to 459. Also, the number of people being admitted to hospital at one stage in mid-April, for example, was between 50 and 60 people. That's down to an average of about 17 at the moment. That's the number of people being admitted to hospital per day. Another figure they look at is the number of people in ICU. That's very significant because a lot of the restrictions were based on could ICU cope and was their capacity. That has fallen down as well. There was at one stage around 140 people. That's down to around 58. And again, people being admitted to ICU was at one stage in mid-April between 8 and 10. That's now between 1 and 2. So they're seen as very positive figures. They're figures that they're looking at as they look at easing restrictions. They're the type of figures clearly that they wanted to see as they gave government advice on what to do next. Yeah.
So with all eyes on easing of restrictions, when and more especially how we can have a drink in the pub is something that exercised callers to Wednesday's Liveline. Dublin publican Charlie Chalk is opening up 7 of his 9 pubs on June 29th when restaurants are due to open, and he'll be serving food with his pints and observing all of the protocols. However, not everyone is in agreement with this.
Frank, your pint please.
Great, Joe. That's all there is. It's great with the publicans.
In what way?
Well, I'll tell you what way, Joe. As far as I'm concerned, pubs and drinking dens should be the last to open. At the moment, Joe, we're all doing everything. We're trained now. We're standing in queues without thinking twice about it. We're washing hands. We're doing everything. You go into a pub, Joe, you buy a pint of alcohol, which is a legal drug. As soon as you get a couple of pints on you, everything's out the window. There'll be people swapping sweaty handshakes, everything. Going into the toilets, everything. The virus will be a cesspit around the city again and the country. We go into another shutdown then, country gone, economy gone. What's Mr. Chalk going to do about that?
Charlie?
Well, if that happens, I'm not going to do anything about it because I'm not capable of doing anything about it. But I can assure him that in my pub, everything would be properly managed. And people will not be handshaking, and people will not be meeting in toilets, because the toilets will be managed and it'll be one at a time going into them. And everything is going to be properly managed, and the food and all is going to be served by professionals, and the whole place is going to be passed by the health boards, and I don't agree with that at all.
Publican Charlie Chalk and Frank with Joe. But a couple of pints in, are we really going to social distance? Here's Peter in Tipperary.
Joe, me personally, I'm drinking since I'm 50 years of age next year. I'm drinking since I was 18, went to a lot of different pubs. Me personally, I think social distance in a pub should be in the same sentence. Because why would you go to a pub if you can't mix with people? The whole idea of going to a pub... Yeah. The whole idea of going to a pub is for to socialise, not to invite people. So if I have to go to a pub, let it be August, September or July, and invite people, I'm not going to go.
Because it is about the social aspect and having a chat
with
people.
And as the other man said earlier on, and I think he got talk up wrong, as he said, like, when you go and you drink 3-4 pints of labour, however many pints it is, people in general become more sociable and more friendly, and sometimes you might have certain people that have a habit of shaking hands or how's it going, or whatever. So I think if it even was to be September and things were to be gone better in the country, and by that stage, like, I just cannot humanly possible see how, I don't care whether it's the biggest pub in Dublin or the smallest pub in Clonakilty, how they can operate and how they're going to monitor social distance. I have a nephew, and he's 30 years of age, and he's doing security bar work since he was 18. And he personally said to me, he said, if he gets a call to do it, he's not taking it on. Because he said, how could he, said, go over and separate two men for just having a general conversation in a pub?
Oh, it's going to be a tricky one for sure. That was Peter on Liveline. Sure, you'd almost need a drink. But be careful. No dancing out there.
You can't do a conga line social distancing.
Or can you?
Shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
The sun-drenched wonder that is Gloria Estefan, and it was she who spoke to Ryan on Monday, prompted by the love of her fan and very buen amigo, Kevin Murnane.
I've been a big fan since I'm a kid. I mean, I'm going back to when I was 9 years old and her big hit, Dr. Beat. My sisters would make me dance to that song over and over, promising me they'd take me to the apartment disco. And I was this little chubby kid with my legs chafing together, sweating profusely. How I didn't go off Gloria, I don't know. But it started then, and that was 1984. And then flash forward to me being a big fan all my life, Twitter, around 2011. Mm-hmm. I didn't have Twitter, but I decided to sign up, and I noticed that Gloria Estefan was online, and she was bringing out a new album, which was called Miss Little Havana, but she put MLH on Twitter and said, can you guess the name? So, of course, me being my mischievous self, said things like magnetic love handles, many lustful habits, magnanimous little hobbits, and it grabbed her attention. And then we started to banter back and forth, and it all began there. And then because she had her album coming out, and because I have a few contacts in around RT in the business, I said to her, if you need any help with anything, I can, help get in touch with DJs here. And she was delighted, more than happy. And then we started to develop this friendship, and we kept in touch. And I flew to Miami October of that year. And Gloria was so kind to me. She met up with me. I stayed in her hotel. She took me out for dinner. We were just hanging out really casually, like friends. It was like we knew each other all our life. So Gloria has that ability. I think because she's such a nice, kind-hearted, down-to-earth person that she just, the moment you meet her, you just feel comfortable with her.
I feel like I know her already now. I mean, I feel like I know her.
And then, lo and behold, for dreams do come true, Miami Calling.
I think, Gloria, your music is like sunshine. It just comes out of the radio and bathes us in a glow and makes us want to dance. And I think we need your music now more than ever to get us up off our derriere and to get moving.
Our collective tushies.
I mean, is that what people say to you down through the years, that your music just fills them with joy and fun?
Well, you know what? I always get thrown back at me that the rhythm is going to get you. This is a fact. You know, I grew up in Sunshine. I was born on an island that I, you know, I left when I was two. I left Cuba, so it's not that I have a lot of memories of Cuba. But I think the reason that Cubans gravitated towards Miami is that it's as close as possible to our native, you know, island. And I'm an island girl. I live on an island right now, Star Island in Miami Beach. I need to be surrounded by water. And our music was born of this environment and this mix of cultures, which is why you have songs like Conga, Dr. B, Rhythm is Gonna Get You, which is a mix of like just dance music, funk, bass lines, and very, very legitimate Cuban congas and these things that I played in the band in my early gig days, and which became a part of our sound. So the weather and everything surrounding us is very much about sunshine and ocean and breeze. And I think that gets through to your music, no matter how, you know, the environment you live in, that you grew up in, that becomes a part of what you create. Every person that creates art or writes or paints or does anything is going to be incredibly influenced by their environment. And I certainly am.
Author Rhythm Is Gonna Get You. That was Human Vitamin D, Gloria Estefan with Ryan on Monday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Evidence emerged this week which indicates that children are not the coronavirus super spreaders we might have suspected. But as with almost everything related to COVID-19, there are caveats. Here's Professor Corina Butler, paediatrician at Crumlin Children's Hospital and president of the Infectious Disease Society of Ireland, with Audrey Carville.
Is it possible to say at this moment in time for certain, or with any degree of certainty, if children are spreaders of COVID-19?
I think the one thing we can say with full certainty is we don't know, and that there are, to use your words, there are very encouraging data emerging, very encouraging trends, but these our assessments are based on very small amounts of evidence, and the truthful answer is we really don't know. We are on a learning curve. But we can look at what information and all the information that's pointing us in that direction. Now, the one thing we do know is that children can get infected.
But Audrey Carville wanted to know just what made the kids so very special.
Why might children be less likely to infect others than adults, for example?
Well, that's a very interesting research question. There are lots of reasons we might speculate. We could think that, first of all, that for whatever reason, in terms of the way the virus comes into our body, latches on to certain receptors, that children are simply not at the stage where they acquire so much virus, or it's as easy for the virus to replicate, and they may simply have much, much lower levels of virus in their system than adults who get it. There are very practical reasons, in the sense that a child who has something that is transmitted by droplet, and that it's relying on cough and expelling those secretions, children just don't have as forceful coughs as adults or older, you know, teenagers or that. Or it could be something much more different. Children, we know, get a lot of different coronaviruses. There are others in this family, and they're getting common colds all the time. And maybe there's a level of cross-protective immunity from those other viruses, and children who are being constantly exposed may have a little bit more immunity to this virus than others. There's lots of potential reasons, and we don't know the answer to that yet.
COVID-19, more questions than answers. That was Professor Corina Butler on Thursday's Morning Ireland. However, childcare, and who quite literally holds the baby, remains a huge issue for parents. On Wednesday evening, Minister Catherine Sapone cancelled a scheme intended to go live on Monday that would have seen healthcare workers have their children cared for in their homes. But it turned out only 9, count 'em, 9 childcare providers had applied to do that. On Thursday, Sarah McInerney spoke to Dr. Laura Durkin, consultant rheumatologist at Beaumont Hospital, as to how she and her colleagues were coping.
Good childcare allows every other industry to work, and I think, you know, is like the essential cornerstone of feminism. And I know that, you know, children are obviously the responsibility of both of their parents, but lots of this does fall to women, and it's particularly pertinent in healthcare, where we do have a mostly female workforce, and many of them have young children. And I suppose, you know, it's been a cumulative challenge when added to, you know, the high rate of COVID infections that we'd have in healthcare workers, high number of contacts requiring isolation, you have to stay home from work. And then when you add on top of it, then people who, you know, have not been able to come to work because literally there is nobody to mind their children. It has been an added kind of staffing pressure.
And Sarah asked Dr. Durkin about something she had tweeted.
Yeah, and I know you tweeted this morning that you think there's been a major gap in that management in terms of the pandemic plan when it comes to childcare. And you raised the question as to whether there's an element of sexism there.
I do. I know it's terrible to be like screaming sexism at every available opportunity, but I do wonder whether or not childcare was left a little bit on the back burner because of the male voice has been much stronger in this pandemic than the female. You know, to give them, I know they've had an awful lot on their plates, but there's been a couple of areas where, and I think childcare is a central one, where healthcare workers, their lives outside of health was of their jobs was not really considered in the management plan. And if we look to kind of other countries and what they did, you know, in France, we had the schools providing frontline childcare where the teachers with social distancing in a classroom were looking after the kids. Even in the States, frontline workers, and this includes, you know, supermarket workers and people who work in trades that were essential, that they opened a certain number of creches and that they opened aftercare, after school facilities for those people so that they could kind of, you know, utilize those. The same in Japan and in other countries in Asia. But it looks like they've managed in lots of other countries to provide frontline workers with this safety net. And this would have been something that could provide us with a blueprint to move forward and provide the greater workforce with kind of safe childcare. But if you ask a random person to go into the home of healthcare workers, often two healthcare workers, they have no control on that environment and there's no way to reliably make that safe for them.
Dr. Laura Durkin with Sarah McInerney on Thursday. On the History Show, we heard more about Manon Aheron when they remembered the presidential campaign of 1990, a hefty 30 years ago, when one Mary Robinson changed Irish history and shaped how a whole generation of Irish women might view the possibilities open to them. But before we get into that campaign, here's a little reminder of the Ireland of the 80s and 90s, courtesy of journalist Jennifer O'Connell, who was on Des's Desert Discs.
So I was born in 1975, so I was like 10 in 1985. And that was still like a very oppressive time to be a little girl, I think, particularly in Ireland. It was a very kind of forbidding country. And I think we sort of forget that now, but there was a huge amount of rules about how girls were supposed to behave, like everything from the kind of shoes that we were allowed to wear to, you know, how we were supposed to interact or like ideally never interact with boys. And there was the constant, you know, the constant backdrop of like the dark whispered stories about, you know, the fallen women and the silly, stupid girls who got cut out. And I remember hearing those stories, but not really understanding what they meant or what they were alluding to. So there was that kind of atmosphere. It was like a low rumble of the background to my childhood. But then at the same time, I was really lucky to have had this incredibly progressive educational experience in the second half of my educational life, and also very kind of liberal parents who really believed in us and told us that we could be everything. So, you know, on the one hand, I was going to school with the nuns, like a lot of girls of my age and women of my age would have done. And you know, in the nuns, the worst thing that you could possibly be was a notice box. And I remember from a really young age deciding that I wanted to be a journalist, but I had to keep that a secret because it sounded like such a notice boxy thing to want to be. So I there was one occasion, I think, when I was about probably around 7 or 8 in school, and they asked us to write down on a piece of paper what we wanted to be. And I looked around the classroom and everybody else had written down a mammy or a teacher or a hairdresser or maybe a nurse. And I had in my head that I wanted to be a journalist, but I didn't really know how to spell it, I don't think. And I definitely didn't want to write it down. So I settled for dentist. And I remember the nun picked it up and looked at it and went, girls can't be dentists.
However, against those confines and restrictions, a little revolution was happening bit by bit. Change was coming.
The seeds of the social change that we've seen in the last few years. And when we talk about that social change, I think we talk about it as though it's a phenomenon that just happened in kind of the 2010s onwards. But actually, when I look back now and analyse my childhood, and I, you know, obviously you don't analyse your childhood when you're a child, but I think that there was that Ireland of the contrasts was emerging. So, you know, on the one hand, you had all these rumblings about the troubles in the north and the private troubles in people's lives. And there was a lot of, it was a very like euphemistic place. We didn't really talk directly about things. We talked about them in euphemisms. But at the same time, there was this kind of emerging appetite for change. And there was some really incredible female journalists that I would have been inspired by, and women like Mary Robinson. I felt like Ireland was emerging out of its chrysalis then and becoming a much more progressive place.
A little scene setting there. That was Jennifer O'Connell with Des Cahill on Tuesday. But back to 1990 and the History Show. Julian Clancy spoke to Conor Horgan about his photograph of the presidential hopeful.
Well, this is the black and white photograph of Mary Robinson, which was would have been her main election poster. She's wearing a kind of a shawl collar, bit of makeup. She's looking directly down the camera. There's a kind of, you can see a bit of steel in the eyes, which was always there and mark of the very clear and sharp intellect that's behind those eyes. But there's also a bit of warmth, and the smile is not huge, but it's sincere.
And in retrospect, even the background of the image seems to take on greater significance.
I would have picked this kind of cloudy canvas background totally instinctively. There was not necessarily a kind of feeling of, and then we put this because it means that, but it just, because it felt right. And when you look at it now, it does feel right. And it has a sense of a kind of a black and white version of a dramatic sky. And dramatic skies can kind of say destiny.
If all that sounds dramatic, that's because the 1990 election was one of the most dramatic elections of our time. There was that damning audio tape that buried Brian Lennon in a political scandal. The searing attack from Padraig Flynn on Mary Robinson's family values, as well as this huge mobilisation of female voters. It all climaxed with a win that changed the country forever.
Knowing what I know now, I'm very proud to have been involved in that campaign. It ended up being a much bigger deal than any of us thought that it would be. I'm glad that I was there and glad I was part of it.
I was elected by men and women of all parties and none. By many with great moral courage, who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon Aaron.
President Mary Robinson, as heard on the History Show. However, the lack of women in politics, still an issue. On Thursday, Sarah McInerney spoke to Tara Farrell, one of the founders of See Her Elected, or SHE, a new initiative aimed at encouraging women in rural Ireland to get involved in politics. And she gave us some rather stark figures.
The stats are very poor. Overall, the percentage of women in local government in Ireland is around 26%. Now, some councils with, you know, more urban areas will have much higher percentages of female representation. So the likes of Dunleary Rathdown is at 48%. But if you look at Donegal, 4 out of 37 seats held by women, you know, Longford, 2 out of 18, Roscommon, Leitrim and Sligo, just 17% women, Mayo, 10%. So it is an issue in rural areas. And really the SHE School is about demystifying local politics, unpicking the maze of all of these acronyms that you hear, like PPNs and SPCs and LCDCs. And we want to explore the structures at local level to see where women can play a key role in decision making, and perhaps encourage some of our SHE School participants then to make that leap onto the ballot paper.
However, one of those women dipping their toes into the political whirlpool was Bláthnaid Gallagher. And although she had been involved in the community and local events, making the move into politics was not something she had considered.
I have been involved in lots of things at community level. Like, I'm chair of the Model in Sligo, I'm editor of the Leitrim Guardian, all voluntary things. But so I would never want to get into big politics.
Why? Why not?
Because I suppose I have two teenagers now. Both have just left school. My daughter started first year last September. That frees me up. But now I have my elderly mother, which becomes a caring factor as well. But there's lots of little barriers. Like, I suppose it's very difficult for women to make it in that. I mean, there's lots of things. For example, you look at the GAA in the community. People are very involved in GAA, but if you look, mostly the men are doing the coaching and they're doing the direction. The women are behind the scenes getting the guys and the girls out to the games. But somehow it doesn't seem to be it's very difficult. Like up here in North Leitrim, where in our local council area, there's one woman. In County Leitrim, there are three women councillors out of 18. And that's been, like, I think it was four once, but that's it. So we're just not breaking that barrier. And I think as a woman, it's kind of much harder to put yourself out there. When we put ourselves out there and become, you know, kind of aggressive, sometimes you're seen as a harrogant. You know, all of those old-fashioned terms become about women. And I don't know, I just found it harder to put myself out there.
Bláthnaid Gallagher with Sarah McInerney. Over on Arena. It was time for the doctor. The music from Doctor Who, 1963, written by Ron Granger, but crucially realised by Delia Derbyshire at the Radiophonic Workshop at the BBC. Tony Clayton Lee joined Sean Rocks to give us some background to Derbyshire.
Very clever, very, very brainy, accepted at both Oxford and Cambridge. He applied after graduating to Decca Records for a position there, only to be told by Decca Records that the company didn't employ women in their recording studios. So she went to Europe, came back to the UK, started working in the BBC in 1960 at the, as you said, the Radiophonic Workshop. And it was there that she really applied her intuitive knowledge of the then really quite basic electronic instrumentation. Delia kind of came pretty much in line with the nascent experimentation of other musicians as well. She didn't receive a co-writing credit until the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. And that is because throughout the 60s and 70s and possibly even the 80s, the BBC wanted their own Radiophonic Workshop personnel to be completely anonymous. In other words, they wanted the workshop people to work as a kind of united team with nobody singled out.
And Ron Granger, to be fair, felt that she should be credited as co-composer. He wasn't looking for all the glory.
Yeah. Absolutely, because he realised when she had presented her own realisation of his theme tune, he expressed surprise and asked, who is that boy? Who wrote that piece of music? And she had to explain to him that the treatment was so radical, but also so much of her own mind as well, that it actually was his piece of music.
Tony Clayton Lee on Arena on the electronic pioneer that was Delia Derbyshire. Let's have another wee blast. Welcome back. On Tuesday, former Secret Service Special Agent Evie Pomporis spoke to Ryan. She had served as protective detail for three US presidents and is a recipient of the Medal of Valor Award. And she spoke to Ryan about working in Building 7 on 9/11 and not fully realising what was happening as the buildings began to crumble around her.
Can you take us through a little bit about the descent into madness, you know, and the reality of it not just being an electrical fault and your endeavours to comprehend just how serious it all was and what you did.
When the first plane hit, thinking that it was some type of explosion, I went with my colleagues with our aid kits to go help, and then the second plane came. And it was madness. It's interesting when you watch the footage from years ago, at least here in the U.S., they don't really show a lot of what happened. They don't show all the people jumping because there were so many people jumping. They don't show the chaos. They don't show they don't show people's behavior, and it's wild. You'd see some people running, some people, you know, frozen in place, some people, you know, just completely confused. And we tried to get into the second tower after I had gotten hit, and we couldn't because of all the debris raining down. I mean, there was debris and parts of the building coming down, and literally you had to just jump out of the way, and in addition to getting out of the way from people jumping and somebody not falling on you and hurting you or, quite frankly, killing you, So we set up a triage trying to help people, because at this point people are swarming out and we're trying to figure out who really does need aid and then who really is in shock. And there were so many people kind of in shock. And that really was the crux of what I stayed to do, to help people, to give aid to those who needed it. You know, when the first building came down, I didn't know it was going to come down, and I was sheltered in place. I just found a corner, and I just tucked myself away there and just waited for it to happen. The thing was, the tower was so tall that when the debris came down, it kind of rained everywhere, and it's luck.
And rather than run from such a dangerous situation, she stayed.
I stayed to help because I knew the second tower was going to come down, and there were still people there. And we just started pulling people, evacuating people, helping. There was a school nearby, Stuyvesant High School. Mm-hmm. We're trying to help to get the kids out of the school. I mean, I remember one kid was either injured or in shock, and we were carrying him out. I stayed till the end, as did some of my other colleagues. You know, and it's kind of like when, you know, we're going through something similar, not the exact same thing, but, you know, this is what we experience. In life, we experience these difficult moments, and you have a choice who you want to be. And even in something like this, we all have a choice who we want to be when it's all over. You know, we're all going to look back and be like, who was I during this pandemic? How did I handle myself? Did I help others? Did I do right? Did I do right by humanity? And that's all you can try to do.
Former Secret Service agent Evie Pomporis with Ryan on Tuesday. But getting through this whole thing is not easy, and for some, it's taking a very severe toll. On Wednesday, Fergal Rooney, head of psychology at St John of God's, spoke to Claire Byrne on the News at One about the dramatic increase in admissions directly caused by COVID-19.
How that looks is, you know, people for whom relationships have become strained, people who've developed, you know, real intense fear of becoming sick, or those who are impacted by separation from loved ones, people who are struggling to cope, to adjust with a really different way of living, others worried about their job. There's a whole ambit of human difficulties that present, but I suppose what we're seeing are people who are presenting where that has escalated to such an extent that they require a specialist service such as ours.
Are you seeing people coming back to you, maybe who have been involved with you through addiction?
We are, and you know, many people, you know, struggle over a long period of time with mental health difficulties, and unfortunately the COVID reality has just put additional pressure and burden on people that we would previously have worked with, and they're coming, you know, with mood-related difficulties, with anxiety issues, with addiction issues. But equally, we're seeing a whole new cohort of people presenting for the first time. And there are people whose threshold of coping or of resilience has just been pushed into that territory where they require a specialist intervention.
Fergal Rooney on the News at One. On Thursday, Ray Darcy spoke to relationship counsellor Ray O'Neill about loneliness and how to cope. And he read this letter.
I'm a 62-year-old retired widow without children. I have a wide circle of friends, none of whom I can see at the moment due to the restrictions, nor can I see any of my family. I know that in lots of ways I'm very lucky. I have a decent pension, a garden which keeps me busy for a few hours every day, and lots of people to speak to on the phone. Nevertheless, I am desperately lonely. I miss the contact with humans and my social life. I keep busy and try not to think about it, but would appreciate any advice you can offer.
These are not the only people in the country, or indeed in the world, feeling these things. And there's only four words that can offer any kind of hope or respite from this, which I base and trust so much of my professional and personal life on. This too will pass.
Right, yeah.
Like, that's all we can do. Is it is awful, but we got to be grateful for the things we can be grateful for, while also being honest about the things that give us despair or frustration or pain.
Mm.
It's okay to be desperate. It's okay to be lonely. You're a human being, and this is an awful time for you, particularly because they've lost their partners.
Yeah.
And although it seems that we might be inching ever closer to an easing of restrictions, it is this almost but not quite that is getting to people, particularly if they're living alone.
One of the things that's really important, because hopefully, please God, next week we'll see the beginning of the beginning of the end, or a change, is we are always most exhausted when the pressure begins to be lifted from us.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of people, myself included, will start feeling incredibly exhausted because the light is at the end of the tunnel.
That's interesting. And I suppose, and I hate using this word, but it's the only word that describes it for something that's so horrific for a lot of people. But there was a novelty element at the beginning, which gives something an energy, doesn't it?
It does. And again, it was interesting because a lot of the analogy was being used about Christmas and New Year and how we're off work. And again, Christmas and New Year are gorgeous for some people, but nightmares for other people.
Mm.
And it has gone on for 2 months. And again, it's, you know, there is some light at the end of the tunnel and we've got to believe in that. But again, things can shift and change. All we can do is be honest. I mean, there's only so much Netflix you can watch.
Yeah, it's like that, the witching hour, you know, isn't that the most difficult hour is the one before dawn?
Exactly. Yeah. It's always darkest before the dawn.
There you go.
Oh, let's hope so. That was psychologist Ray O'Neill with Ray Darcy. Now, sit back, close your eyes, and for the next minute or so, let's go back to 1959 and one of the last journeys of the Hill of Howth tramway, courtesy of Joe Linane, as heard on Bowman on Sunday.
To my left here, there's the Bailey Lout House, a coaster carving its delicious way through a very calm sea. And the prospect in the distance of perhaps a cup of tea or a glass of something at the inn at the top of the summit, which we are now fast approaching. Did I say fast approaching? Slowly approaching, deliciously, charmingly, wonderfully approaching. That is something that Dubliners, Irelanders, and foreigners are going to miss in just a few days' time. As one lady said, progress must go on. The Howth tram has to go. What a pity. But it's pulling to a stop at this moment. There is the inn. Lounges, bars written on it, tea rooms, ice creams. Progress has come to the summit, and the old Howth tram has to go.
Oh, that was beautiful. That was from Bowman on Sunday. On the poetry programme, Olivia O'Leary spoke to Ewan Sandberg McGinney, who comes from a mixed background of Scottish Gaelic and Swedish South Sami. And she asked this question.
What is a yoik? Tell us before you sing one.
Yes, a yoik, as you say, is a traditional way of singing. And when we talk about yoiking, the most important part is not really the words, because you can have lyrics to a yoik, but the melody. And we say that the melody carries the meaning of what you're trying to express to people, so that over time you may lose the words, but the melody gets passed on through generations. So, for example, I know a yoik for the river that I live next to that is 400 years old. And the words that it had to begin with, those are long, long gone. But the melody is still there. So we still think of it as that yoik.
Could you sing us that particular yoik now?
Oh, yes, of course I can. So it's called Upmeyano. It means the Ume River. And this is the yoik of the Ume River.
And the sudden full stop is very dramatic.
It is, in a way, because we say that with a yoik, it doesn't really have a beginning. It doesn't have an end. So when you start yoiking, you're basically just continuing something that has been dormant, so that whoever then yoiks the same yoik, they're just continuing your yoik. So, I mean, I could go on for years, but when it ends, I just feel it in myself.
What an amazing sound. That was Ewan Sandberg McGuinney on the Poetry Programme. And this week, so Áine Ní Ghlin appointed Laureate na nOg, agus bhí sé ag caint le Fáchnó Dhuiscáil ar tuasáilte.
Mar chuid an ról, ba mis ag iri dín óg a spraga chun níos mó leabhar a léamh, ba mis ag iri glúan óg scríonóirí a spraga chun níos mó scríonóireachta a dhéanamh, ba mis ag iri córa a spraga maidir le litríochta fáistí. Ach ar nóí mar chuid lárnach den cinál mission persanta a bheith agamsa, bete ag iri gnian fran chorimíochta a bhanú idir scríonóireacht na gaeilge do chéin óg agus scríonóireacht an bhéarla. Be mé gurí go bhhuiisi an taantas céanana, be mé gurí go méid deis ag páistí ile na tíre. Leabhar gaiile sean sa bheitá, leabhar gaiile a léamh mar phléisiúr seachas tíireach mar obair scola.
Laureate na nOg Áine Ní Ghlin as heard on tuasáilte on Radio na Gaeltachta. Well, we are almost at a finish here on Playback. And if you're planning a Zoom quiz this weekend, maybe up the ante. Here's Stand Up and Be Funny finalist Justine Stafford with Ray.
I tell you, the one thing I miss with online quizzes is the raffle. You really miss that. Yeah. That's what it's all about, you know, getting a salmon-coloured ticket.
Yeah, salmon-coloured ticket, small number, Z56DO. Yeah.
Ooh, for the tin of biscuits. Well, that is it for this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Someone I've needed so long. For once unafraid, I can go where life leads me. Somehow I know I'll be strong. For once I can touch what my heart used to dream of long before I knew. Oh, someone warm like you would make my dream come true. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For once in my life, I won't let sorrow hurt me. Not like it's hurt me before. For once, I have something I know won't desert me. I'm not alone anymore. Oh, once I can say this is mine, you can't take it. Long as I know I have love, I can make it. For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Hey, yeah. Oh, I believe it. You can't take it!